Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
Some people just seem to have everything go their way. They always get what they want right when they want it. And sometimes, they may even be able to get away with murder. But what happens when their luck runs out? Can even the most fortunate individuals have their pasts catch up to them? This is True Crime Cast.
Hello and welcome back to True Crime Cast. As always, I'm Jamie and I'm here with John. What's up, man?
Hey, man. Good to be back in the studio with you tonight. We are on the verge of a pivotal moment in our friendship coming up this Saturday. Our listeners will have already experienced this in real life, but what happens on Saturday,
big guy? Yeah, Kentucky, number 5 in the country, coming off a loss, will take on the number 1 Tennessee Volunteers in basketball.
I'm not expecting a great night. So it's at Kentucky. I'm expecting Tennessee to suffer its first SEC loss and its second loss of the season. What are you expecting?
I think it's going to be a good game. I really think it could go either way. Kentucky's not lost 2 in a row in Rupp Arena since John Calipari's been there, and they lost on Tuesday. They're going to be mad, but Tennessee's rolling, so it's going to be tough. I mean, if things don't go well and John and I have a falling out, then this may be our last episode.
Yeah, we hope you guys have enjoyed the run. Hopefully Tennessee pulls off a win and we can keep going.
Yeah, we'll see. John, a lot going on. I was just talking to you off air. I was looking at our download numbers the other day. For really, since we began, Australia has been second in downloads on our list of countries. And then the last month, Great Britain, the UK has really caught up to Australia. There's really, and we're talking thousands of downloads here, there's 8 downloads that separate those two. So we're issuing a competition between Great Britain and Australia to see who can have the most True Crime Cast downloads. So tell your friends to download our podcast, to check us out, share. So we're going to let this run through the end of February, and whoever has the most total downloads at the end of February, we're going to let listeners from that country choose a case from their country that we will cover. So let's try to get those up. Does that sound good to you, John?
Man, that sounds great. We also have another challenge going, Jamie, over on our Patreon. We've said for the last few weeks that if we can get 50 patrons, we will do a Q&A session where our listeners can ask us anything they want, and we may or may not answer those questions. So we are looking forward to that. We had a new Patreon member join since our last recording. Her name is Samantha Nicole. So, Samantha, thank you so much for supporting the show, and we look forward to saying thank you to all you other folks who have just been on the cusp of joining Patreon but have not for whatever reason. Today is your day. Yeah, make it happen, Captain.
John, I gave a couple plugs last week. I talked a little about the Jinx, and that's actually we'll dive into that a little bit more later. I also want to talk a little bit more about Case Closed, the podcast from Macmillan Publishing. It's about Erin Corwin, who on a summer day in 2014 kissed her husband goodbye. She went for a hike in the Joshua Tree National Park, and she never came back. 2 months later, her body was found in an abandoned mine shaft in the desert. The resulting investigation brought up old secrets, and it really shook the small marine town community where Erin and her husband were living. You can hear that whole story on the podcast, Case Closed. It goes for an entire season on this one story. I think episode 4 is going to come out the same day that this episode drops on iTunes. So go check that out and subscribe. I think you'll really enjoy it. Any other housekeeping to cover, John?
Man, we have an Etsy page. We have Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I've been having a lot of fun posting stuff on Instagram. I have a personal account, but I think the last thing I posted was like 2017. So Instagram's a fun thing. So check us out. All those things. You can find us at True Crime Cast, of course. Yeah, man. I think that's the housekeeping. You want to dive into this case?
Yeah, man. I'm ready. Are you?
Yeah, man. Why don't you get us rolling tonight?
All right. Very good. Like I mentioned a little earlier, and I kind of referenced last week, I realize it came out in 2015, John, but I just got around to watching The Jinx. I just got HBO. So I've watched The Jinx. I know you haven't. So I think it's going to be fun for us to kind of talk about the story that takes place during, before, and after that documentary came out on HBO and kind of process it from two different angles. It's the story of a guy named Robert Durst. Robert's the son of Seymour Durst, who was a real estate mogul in New York. No relation to Fred Durst, John. Do you know who Fred Durst is?
I was hoping we would bring this up. He is the lead singer of a little band called Limp Bizkit, who was probably one of my favorite bands when I was in high school.
They were huge when we were in high school, right? I referenced this to some people here in my office when I was talking about this episode, and they had no idea what I was talking about.
I'm going to tell you a story. I woke up and drove my little car from Jellicoe, Tennessee, to the big town of La Follette when their Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavored Water album dropped, so I could be the first in line. Jamie, I was the only one in line that morning to get that record. So, yeah, I've been a big fan for a long time. He is not who we're talking
about
today.
Not the same Durst family. Don't be confused. We do not want to taint the good name of Fred Durst and Limp Bizkit.
I don't know that you can do any worse than he already has, buddy.
Robert Durst was born on April 12th in 1943. He grew up in Scarsdale, New York. He had two brothers and a sister. By all accounts, though, John, he really didn't get along well with them. He clashed with his siblings, especially his brother Douglas, who now runs Seymour, their father's real estate company. Robert would go on, as he grew up, to get a bachelor's degree in economics from Lehigh University. He played lacrosse in college, and he was the business manager for the school paper. After he graduated, he went to work for his dad, went into the family business, and he had a really hard time, John, when his brother Douglas got promoted over him to take over the company. If you've seen the documentary itself or any footage, Robert is such an odd guy. You can tell he's awkward, he's hard to talk to, his body language is just so hard to process what he's doing when he talks to you. And you get to see a lot of him talking in The Jinx. Like I said, that's a documentary that aired on HBO in the spring of 2015. It was by the same guys who made Crime Town, which I know is one of your favorite podcasts, John.
Oh, yeah. I love those guys.
Mark Smerling and Zach Stewart Pontier.
That makes me want to watch it all the more, really.
It is really good. So it follows some crimes that Robert Durst has been accused of. And within the documentary, they actually uncover some evidence that's huge, and we'll get to that at some point. But get us started on these events for Durst's life, and why did they make this documentary?
Yeah, so, I mean, like you mentioned, I have not seen The Jinx, but just researching this case, it's very obvious that some really odd circumstances and some weird stuff and some possible criminal activity just seems to follow this guy around. But let's start at the beginning. When he was 7 years old, he witnessed something that would be very traumatic. He witnessed his own mother's death. This is an odd story, so I want to dive into it a little bit with you. Let's process it while we go. But apparently, his mother was on his roof, and she was up there fixing something. While his mother's on the roof, his father calls little Rob, or Robert, however you want to call him, over to the window, and he asks his son to wave at his mother. Well, Jamie, he gets to the window just in time to see his mother fall to her death. So, I mean, just right off the bat, this family is extremely wealthy. Why in the world was the mother on this roof allegedly fixing something? I should mention it's freezing outside. They're very wealthy. Why didn't they have somebody else fixing something? What's the story here? Do we know any more about this?
Yeah, it's my understanding that the family put forth this story that she was out there fixing something and accidentally fell. Most people believe that it was a suicide, that she climbed up on the roof and jumped off herself. And Robert's the only one that has put forward the story about his dad drawing him to the window. His siblings say that that wasn't true. They didn't know what was happening. They knew she was on the roof. And then the next thing they knew, they were ushered off to a neighbor's house and heard sirens. So either way, his mother did fall or jump from the roof to her death when he was seven, and he at least saw her up there. So this had to be traumatic for a kid like that.
Yeah, I mean, and even if he didn't see her fall, I mean, losing your mom at such an early age in that fashion is traumatic in and of itself. So if he did see her do that, I mean, I can't imagine what the kid went through. He did go through some counseling services. one of the counselors that he would see would throw around some words that would frighten any parent. One of those words was the possibility of schizophrenia. It was obvious to everyone that was around this kid that there was something going on. He was definitely a troubled young man. Jamie, let's jump up to 1971, and that's when he meets Kathleen McCormick. She was known as Kathy. They would end up getting married in 1973. Kathy had been a dental hygienist. She was attending Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. That sounds like one of the fanciest things you could possibly say about yourself and put on a resume, right?
I know Albert Einstein was a genius, but I don't think he was a doctor. So why are we naming medical schools after him? And feel free to correct me, listeners, but that's just the first thing that came to mind is why would he be the name on a medical school?
I mean, to a moron like me, it sounds awesome, but you're absolutely right. It makes no sense. She was in her last year of school, Jamie, when the unthinkable happens. She actually goes missing. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it was on the evening of January 31st of 1982. Kathy had left her friend's house to go home and talk to Robert. And he had actually called her while she was at the friend's house. And she left upset. And she was going to go home and talk to him. Robert and Kathy had a home in South Salem, New York. But they also owned an apartment in the city. I mean, rich people can own two homes, even if one of them is in downtown New York. According to Robert, he said that Kathy had told him that she wanted to go in and stay at their apartment so she wouldn't have as big of a commute to medical school in the morning. Albert Einstein College of Medicine's in the Bronx. It's in New York. He didn't want her to take the car because then he would be stranded at their house in South Salem. And they got into an argument about that. He admitted that there was some pushing and shoving. He said that sometimes their arguments got physical, but there was no abuse, which is a contradiction in and of itself right there. So eventually he'd agreed to drive her to the train station so she could take a train to their apartment. There were early reports, John, that the doorman said he saw her come into the apartment that night. But later, he was unable to recall seeing this. He said he saw somebody that looked like her, but he could not confirm that he saw Kathy arriving at their downtown apartment. The next morning, the dean of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine received a phone call from a woman saying that it was Kathy and she was sick and unable to come to school. Robert told the police as well that he spoke to Kathy on the phone once she got to her apartment. And he would actually say during the documentary, John, that he was hoping he could say that to place her in New York to get the police off of his back for her disappearance, even though he didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, man, if you listened to last week's episode, we talked about the disappearance of Tara Grant and her eventual murder. Her husband was the number one suspect. And just like that, in this particular case, Robert would, of course, be the primary suspect. I mean, it's kind of simple to put two and two together there. However, there's no physical evidence linking him to this particular crime. There's really no evidence suggesting that anything happened to her. I mean, it's like she's just really up and vanished. Her family believed that he had something to do with her disappearance, but like I said, there's really nothing to point towards in this crime. There was some circumstantial evidence that we can talk about, but no physical evidence at all. So one of the first things we should mention is that prior to her disappearance, she told him that she wanted the divorce and that she wanted $250,000 in a settlement from him for the divorce. Is that enough to make any red flags pop up?
You know, when you said it, it is. But when you think about how much money this family had, if he really has problems with this woman, to get her out of his life, that's not that much money for them. They're multimillionaires. It's a significant amount of money to anyone, but this isn't get rid of somebody money for them in my mind.
Right. I'm sure that anybody would hate to write a check for that much money, but I mean, we're going to talk about some stuff later. This guy could sneeze and accidentally lose that much money.
Yeah.
So it's really not for his life that big of a deal. But anyway, another potential red flag that pops up was you mentioned the pushing and shoving, the argument that they had. Actually, a few weeks before her disappearance, she ended up going to the hospital with bruises on her face. She actually told some friends that he was abusive towards her. So that's another huge red flag that pointed towards Robert in that situation. But there were a couple of phone calls that were made that were very suspicious. Shortly after Kathy disappeared, there were some collect calls that were made to the Durst organization from Ship Bottom, New Jersey. Now, this was near a heavily wooded area, and it was well within driving distance of the Durst home in South Salem, New York. Robert regularly called his business Collect, so I feel like we need to stop there and kind of explain this a little bit. How does a collect call work, Jamie?
So back before everyone had a cell phone, if you wanted to call a house or a business and it was outside of a particular area code, you would absorb some extra charges for making a long-distance call. Or you could call that person collect, and when they answered the phone, they would be prompted to agree to pay for the call on their end. So he doesn't want to pay long-distance charges, even though he's a multimillionaire, so he's putting the bill on the company by calling collect.
So when you would receive a collect call, the first thing you would hear would be the operator saying, "You are receiving a collect call from," and then you would get to state your name. When I was in high school, I had to use a payphone to call my parents to pick me up, but I wouldn't carry like change in my pocket, you know? So I would do a collect call, and when the operator prompted me to say my name, I would say, "I'm at Brandon's house, pick me up." So my parents would hear that you got a collect call from, "I'm at Brandon's house, pick me up." So I wouldn't have to spend any money. They wouldn't have to pay any money. It was really a win-win. These collect calls were happening from a pretty remote area. A little suspicious, right?
It seems to be. And he and another guy were the only ones that ever called the business collect. And the other guy's alibi was pretty straightforward. So it appears that Robert just happened to be in Ship Bottom, New Jersey, which I had to Google several times before I got the right spelling there. So he could have been somewhere else in a remote area where you may dispose of someone if you wanted to. So it definitely looks shady.
I guess the craziest part to me is the next part, Jamie, and that is that authorities knew this, but they never moved any further in their investigation of Robert Durst.
Yeah. They never followed that lead. And it was a long time before anything would circle back around to him being a suspect in a major way. And we'll come back to that. But during this entire ordeal, John, Robert had a spokesperson that spoke to the media on his behalf. Like we said, he's really awkward. I couldn't imagine him standing in front of a group of media and defending himself and not looking like the most guilty person on earth. So he had his longtime friend, Susan Berman, speak for him on his behalf. She actually had her dad had been in the mafia, and she had written books about the mafia and the way that the mafia actually operated. She had moved out to LA, and she was working on screenplays and manuscripts for shows and movies about the mafia. And she was very well-spoken, so she would get up in front, and she would go to bat for Robert and say, "There's no way that he did this." And they remained friends for years. She actually, one time she was out in L.A., John, and she was having trouble selling some of her manuscripts. Robert would send her money. You mentioned that he could sneeze and lose $250,000. He had a friend ask for money, and he just sent her a $50,000 check. I feel like when you and I go out to lunch, like, it's awkward if one of us asks to pick up the $7 Chinese buffet bill. Could you imagine just handing me a $50,000 check? And if you can, would you?
I was actually hoping that it would be the other way around, that you could imagine writing me a check for that much. But no, I mean, listen, even if I had that kind of money, it seems absurd to be able to write a check for that much money to somebody. I mean, I know that in today's world, I mean, I can't write you a check for more than $11,000 without the government being involved to take out taxes. So it's just an insanely large amount of money to be handing out. That's a year's worth of salary for most working people.
It really is. And unfortunately, like you said earlier, the authorities stopped chasing Robert for this murder for the time being.
Jamie, in 1993, November, there's a district attorney who's newly elected in Westchester County, New York. Her name is Jeanine Pirro. Did I say that right, buddy?
I think that's good.
She was newly elected there in New York in 1993. Interesting, Jamie, she was actually the first woman to hold that position, and she held this office through 2005. Now, one thing that she focused on in particular in her second term was reopening the case of Kathy Durst and her disappearance. She started to pursue some leads. She started to pursue Robert. She started interviewing Kathy's family. In doing so, she was given the name of Robert's closest confidant that she would need to speak to. In late 2000, she reached out to Susan Berman to inquire about what she might know about Kathy's disappearance and Robert's potential role. Before she could meet with Piero in person, Berman was found dead in her home in L.A. She had been shot execution style in the back of the head. Of course, Jamie, the timing of this is pretty suspect when you think about she's being questioned about what she knows about Robert and the disappearance of Kathy. And before all this can take place, she's found murdered in her home. Is this a coincidence, Jamie?
You know, I guess that's what Robert would argue, but it's really hard to see past that, considering that at this point, things just seem to be happening to people around him that are not great.
The only real piece of evidence from Susan's murder was an anonymous letter that was received by police. Now, that letter contained two things that were interesting and noteworthy. Susan's address with Beverly Hills was spelled incorrectly. The person had wrote an E between the L and the Y at the very end of Beverly. The letter also contained the word cadaver, and it was all by itself. So it seemed like this person wanted police to know that there was something going on. There was a dead body that they needed to find. So, Jamie, what do you think about this letter, man?
Well, I mean, the speculation is that somebody wanted the body to be found. There were individuals that tried to say that this was mafia-related because she spoke out about the mafia, but this didn't seem to be a mafia-style hit, and the mafia definitely doesn't seek attention for what they've done. So it seems like someone maybe that cared about Susan, that knew that she was dead and didn't want her body to just sit in the house decomposing. And I know that sounds odd if you're going to kill somebody that you don't want them sitting there unattended or unfound, but it is an odd circumstance that somebody would point to this dead body when they're also trying to get away with murder. So it's a really odd set of circumstances. Of course, police and authorities were suspicious that Robert knew something, especially when they found out that he had recently given her that $50,000 check. So Robert fled, and he was still living in New York at the time, to Galveston, Texas. He moved into a small apartment, and he tried to hide. Janine Pirro was still on his back, chasing him. He knew that he was being suspected for Susan Berman's murder. So he's trying to hide, and in this small apartment building, again, he still has so much money, a really small apartment. When he leaves his apartment, he will dress like a woman and wear a wig to try to disguise himself. Now, being a smart man, Robert also realizes that he doesn't sound like a woman. So not only is he pretending to be a woman in Galveston, Texas, he's pretending to be a mute woman that is unable to speak in order to fly under the radar. And that is until October 9th of 2001, when he was arrested for the murder of another person, Morris Black.
All right, so let's back up a little bit and give them some more information about this particular murder investigation. So on September 30th, 2001, a 13-year-old boy walked upon a human torso on the shoreline of Galveston Bay. Could you imagine your 13-year-old son finding such a horrid sight on the beach there? I mean, that just sounds awful to have went through for that kid.
I can't imagine a 36-year-old Jamie stumbling upon that. That is traumatic, to say the least.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would be horrified. But, so, of course, police were notified about this discovery. Police would eventually find five trash bags on the shore nearby. Two of those bags contained human arms. Two of those bags contained legs. And one was empty, but it had a hole cut in it. Jamie, they never found the head that belonged to this body, even though those other bags washed up on the bay. By October 5th, they figured out that these remains belonged to Galveston native Morris Black. Now, Morris Black was the neighbor of Robert Durst. So again, calamity just seems to follow this guy, right? So many said that Morris Black was a grumpy man, that he was difficult to get along with. Robert would later say that they were actually friends. Now, Maria de Hernandez was another tenant in the building. She told police that she saw Robert loading trash bags into his car on the night that Black went missing. On October 9th, 2001, Robert Durst was arrested for the murder of Morris Black. Now, Jamie, as police often do, they search the car of those that they arrest, especially in this case where he's wanted for murder. In his car, police find a 9mm handgun, a small bag of marijuana, and a bow saw. Now, knowing what we know about Morris Black and his dismemberment, doesn't look great, does it, Jamie?
It certainly does not. It looks about as guilty as you could look.
Now, investigators would eventually say that they do not believe that bow saw was involved in the dismemberment of Black's body. But, of course, this made things look really bad for Durst.
Yeah, Robert Durst was able to post bail because he's super rich, and I don't know if they set it low enough because they thought he lived in this crappy apartment in Galveston that he couldn't afford it. But as he was presumed innocent, as all people are, he was allowed the opportunity for bail, and he went on the run. He took off, John. He went and he shaved his head, and he tried to disguise himself. He even shaved his eyebrows, so completely hairless on his head. He was actually on the run for 7 weeks before he was caught, and it could have been longer if he didn't make a really stupid mistake. On November 30th of 2001, he went into a Wegmans grocery store in Pennsylvania. While he was in there, John, he grabbed a newspaper, a box of Band-Aids, and a $6 chicken sandwich, and he walked out without paying for it. He was caught by security, and they identified who he was, and they returned him to Texas. Now, John, he stole these items for a total of what? Less than 10 bucks, right? He had $500 cash in his pocket, $36,000 of cash in the trunk of his car. He said he stole this stuff just to get away with it. I would think that if you're on the run from a murder charge, that's really not the time to test your luck and just see if you can get away with something. He eventually went to trial in 2003, and he was charged with the murder of Morris Black. In a shocking move, John, he admitted to killing him. He admitted to dismembering and disposing of the body, but he pled not guilty due to self-defense.
Yeah, Jamie, this trial was pretty interesting. He actually took the stand, and we don't normally see that. I mean, we've covered a lot of cases, and we don't see the defendants kind of taking the stand too often when we're talking about a case like this. But he took the stand, and he described the scene where this crime took place. He described that Black had just been evicted from his apartment, and he was very upset. Robert said that he entered the apartment, and Black was sitting there holding a gun. Black stood up, pointing the gun towards Durst. So Durst said that he began to wrestle with Black and tried to wrestle the gun away. And when they fell down to the ground, the gun went off and a bullet went into Black's head. Now, he said that he actually never touched the trigger and the gun went off while they were wrestling. Neighbors would say that they actually heard two shots and Jamie, there was actually a bullet that had went into a wall. So it did kind of look like one had went into the head, one had went into the wall. Durst would say that Black fired a shot at earlier in the day because he was upset about getting the eviction notice. But I don't know. I'm not going to buy that one, are you?
Yeah, the speculation was that, well, Durst said that he had shot the eviction notice as it was hanging on the wall, but the eviction notice was found and completely intact. So his story certainly did not hold up.
So in the meantime, Jamie, we have Durst and Black there. Black has been shot. In this story, it's because they were wrestling and the gun went off. So what did Durst do after? Well, he said that he claimed that he went out and tried to find a neighbor to call 911, but he couldn't find anybody. So when he came back, he knew that he would be in a whole lot of trouble. So he decided to cover it up, you know, because that would make things better, right?
Yeah, that's going to help.
So he admitted on the stand at his trial that he used a paring knife, two saws and an axe to dismember Black's body. He went into detail about this again on the witness stand. Jamie, when he was asked about the empty bag they found in the water, he admitted that he was seeing the bags floating on the water, and he apparently thought that they would sink eventually, but he realized they were not. So what he did was he cut a hole in the bag open to take Morris Black's head out and to dispose of it somewhere else. He apparently thought that if they didn't have the head, then the body would be unidentifiable.
Well, that wasn't true, John, but the absence of the head is really a big point of contention in the trial. Without the head, it's impossible to say how he was shot. You can't reenact someone being shot if you don't know where the bullet entered the head. Was he shot in self-defense? If so, the bullet wound would have probably been near the face as they were wrestling over it in front of him. If the bullet hole was in the back of the head, that could indicate that he was murdered, shot execution style. Without the head, it's impossible to tell. And that's what the defense team would say. They said it's self-defense, and there's no evidence that the prosecution can bring forward to dispute that. The prosecution would say that this guy dismembered a body, and that's not something you do after defending yourself. They said it was intentional murder and intentional dismemberment and tampering of evidence. John, the prosecution knew early on that this was going to be a tough run for them. As soon as Robert Durst got on the stand, the defense started asking him questions about why he was hiding in the first place. He told them about Jeanine Pirro harassing him over his wife's disappearance. And he made a joke about hiding by dressing like a woman and pretending to be mute. And several of the jurors laughed out loud while the defendant, Robert Durst, was on the stand. And there were interviews with attorneys during the Jinx documentary, and they said, we're in trouble. Like, they're eating out of his hands. They are empathizing with the defendant who is claiming self-defense. So the prosecution knew they were in for an uphill battle. Apparently, if self-defense is claimed when somebody is saying they're not guilty of murder, then the burden of proof is on the prosecution to show that that wasn't the case. So the defense is actually asked to prove nothing in a case, right? The prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this happened. So when they throw self-defense in, the burden of proof remains on the prosecution. And regardless of Durst admitting what he did, the blood in his apartment, the bullet hole in the apartment, the fact that he dismembered the body, hid the head, and we still don't know how this guy was killed. And the prosecution could not prove that this was not self-defense. On November 11th of 2003, Robert Durst was found not guilty of the murder of Morris Black. What's your reaction to that, John? How could somebody sit on a stand and say, yes, I killed them, and then I dissected them and disposed of them and be found not guilty?
I'm going to be honest. My reaction is very similar to Robert Durst's reaction. Do you remember his reaction to this when he was in court? He looked over to his attorneys and he said, did they say not guilty? And the attorney said, yeah, they said not guilty. And he said, are you sure? And so I'm thinking the same thing. Like, they just found this guy not guilty of murder, even though he admitted to killing him and dismembering his body. Why in the world would 11 people agree that this guy did not murder this guy? I think I read that Durst spent, I think it was well over $2 million on his attorneys. So apparently, if you murder someone, that is the magic number to get away with it. It is crazy to me.
Well, I mean, we have seen other OJ cases that have shown us that. Yeah, and there are interviews with the jurors in this documentary, and they're saying they still don't think he did it, and they don't think that he did any of these other cases that we're discussing either. So he convinced them that he's a good guy, and I don't know how you can look at this picture and see that.
He did serve some jail time for some other charges, like jumping bail and the gun charge for having the weapon there. But, Jamie, he was out of jail in 2006, so just completely absurd to me. But anyway, let's move on. So I want to fast forward now to 2010. That's when there's a producer who's making a film. What's this guy's name, Jamie?
Andrew Jarecki.
I didn't want to pause and edit that one out, but I'm going to mess up that name.
Appreciate it.
So he was working on a movie called All Good Things, and this was about Robert Durst. It actually stars a pretty famous guy you may know, Ryan Gosling, right?
There are so many surprising things in this case. I feel like casting Ryan Gosling to play Robert Durst may be the most shocking thing we say today.
Have you seen this movie?
No.
We didn't talk about it off the air, so we'll bring our listeners in. I haven't seen it either.
No, John, and I don't. I mean, this was before a lot of this other stuff broke, so it would be interesting to see that producer's take on the story before we know what we know now. But go on.
Yeah, so apparently Robert Durst was very approving of this film. He agreed to let the producer interview him for a documentary. Now, that documentary would be called The Jinx, and that's what we've been talking about for a while. Now, that would air on HBO in the early part of 2015. So, Jamie, this documentary looks fascinating. I've not seen it. You have. In this documentary, Durst talks about the cases that that we've discussed in detail so far. You can tell just how awkward this guy is by the way he speaks. And I've not watched all of it, but I have seen some bits and pieces because I wanted to be somewhat educated when I came into the room today. But, Jamie, there was one particular part that I wanted to talk about, and that is when he's discussing this stuff and he's asked about the testimony that he gave in Morris Black's trial. What happens when he's asked about this, Jamie?
Yeah, he tries to word himself around saying, "I didn't lie on the stand," and he's obviously uncomfortable. So the person interviewing him offers him a break. So the interviewer gets up and walks away. The people running the set kind of walk away too, and he's left sitting there. And he just kind of looks down and he keeps repeating phrases to himself like, "I did not knowingly lie on the witness stand. I did not knowingly lie on the witness stand." That may not be exactly what he said, but repeating things to himself as if he's rehearsing a story that he would be telling on the documentary and trying to convince himself it was true. So when he's doing this, his attorney enters the screen and says, "Hey, Robert, your mic's on. You have to stop talking," and stops him abruptly. So you can tell he's doing things that is not advisable from his attorney, which I can't imagine his attorney advised him to do this documentary anyway, but whatever.
Yeah, so there's another pretty interesting thing that comes up in The Jinx. It's one of the last episodes of the series, and that is when Susan Berman's stepson is interviewed, and the son has discovered a letter written to Susan from Robert Durst. Now, the cameras actually show the envelope, and you can immediately tell that the handwriting is almost a perfect match to the letter that was written and found by police after Berman's death. The most remarkable similarity, though, Jamie, is that, do you remember how I said Beverly Hills was misspelled in the first letter? Well, it is misspelled again in the exact same way on this envelope.
This is a really mind-blowing part of the documentary. And look, let me just press pause right now. We do all kinds of research for these cases, and we don't always harp on our prime source for these things. But in an instance like this, The Jinx became part of this case. So that's why we are referencing it so heavily. We did the same with Tara Grinstead because Up and Vanished became a part of that case. So that's why we're doing that here. But when you get to this point in The Jinx, you're just kind of, it's mind-blowing. I'm thankful I didn't watch this in real time and have to wait a week to see what happened. But if you get to the last episode of the series, it's a setup to confront Robert Durst with this letter. And some really odd things happen in the meantime, John. They tried to get him to go and talk to his brother. He was given a restraining order from his brother. He's arrested for breaking that. He keeps putting off this follow-up interview for this documentary. But finally, they get him to sit down at a conference table. They slide the letter across to him and show him. When he sees this, that the return label has his name on it, and it perfectly matches the cadaver letter that was sent after Susan Berman's death, he reacts in such an odd way, a very fitting way for him, I guess. His eyes turn red. All around his eyes turn red. He becomes flush. He starts burping almost uncontrollably during this. Of course, he continues to deny everything. He says, yes, the handwriting's similar. I can see where the spelling error would cause you to think they were written by the same person. I wrote this letter that has my return address on it. I did not write this other cadaver letter that looks exactly the same. So what they had done, John, they had taken pictures of each of the addresses, and they had just put those two pictures side by side without him being able to see the actual envelope. And he failed to identify which one was his because they looked so much alike. And then, John, they finish with the interview. He denies everything the entire time, and they don't push him to get him to confess or anything. But once again, the set is shut down, and his microphone is left on. He gets up, and he leaves the room, and he walks into the bathroom. And he starts talking to himself. Off screen, in addition to water running and some other things, you hear him say, there it is. You're caught. He says, what the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course. And then it fades to credits. It was such a fascinating scene. He said some other things in there as well that weren't as, I guess, convicting of what he had done. But he says the words, you're caught. I killed them all, of course. Super fascinating.
Jamie, I did happen to catch that clip, and it was very, very chilling to hear him say it. I mean, we can try our best to duplicate his voice, but it's another to hear him say it. It's kind of like the last words of a man who's been found out, you know? But the day the final episode of The Jinx aired in March of 2015 was the day that Durst was arrested in New Orleans for Susan Berman's murder. Jamie, he was actually living under the name Everett Ward, which sounds like a very Tennessee name to be living under. He was tracked there because he kept making calls from the hotel room that he was in to check his personal voicemail. So again, phone calls, not this guy's friend, right, Jamie?
They certainly are not. And I'm assuming this was a voicemail on a landline phone, and he was just calling to check that in, and they could trace those calls.
So due to his own personal illnesses and the flexibility that his defense team needed because their homes were impacted by Hurricane Harvey, it takes a really long time for this trial to go through its different proceedings. Durst entered a not guilty plea on November 7th of 2016, but Jamie, he was not arraigned until November 8th of 2018. Right now, his trial is set to begin on September 3rd, 2019. The judge has ruled, and I think this is pretty interesting, that information from his 2003 trial for Morris Black's murder can be brought up at this new trial.
Yeah, I think that's a huge ruling, and I actually find it to be an odd one. Since he was found not guilty of that crime, obviously he can't be recharged for it, but what he actually did during that can be brought up in this hearing. Having read these things, doing your own research, but not seeing the documentary, how guilty is this guy? And of which crimes?
Man, if you take out the fact that he admitted to Morris Black's death and you don't have any of that information, then I could say that this guy is just a guy who is jinxed. He's unfortunately connected to several people who have either disappeared or been murdered. And we could probably leave it at that. But I think when you tie in what happened to Robert or to Morris Black, that he dismembered this guy's body, even if he did kill this guy in self-defense, right? But he dismembered this body in an attempt to cover it up instead of calling police. That's insane, and I can't believe anything this guy has to say. So I think that he is guilty of all these things that have been brought against him. The disappearance of his wife, Kathy, the murder of Susan Berman, and then the death of Robert Black. I think all these things are something that he is guilty of. What do you think?
It's hard to say that he's not. I know there's no physical evidence about his wife's disappearance, but the circumstantial evidence around her actual disappearance, with the further display of his character, and we know that he killed Morris Black, and it seems like he was very involved in Susan Berman's murder. So knowing that character, adding that to the circumstantial evidence, I think makes it pretty clear that he had something to do with the disappearance of his wife. And John, there are actually a couple other stories I didn't bring up today. There's not enough meat to these stories, I think, to add to what we're doing. But there are two or three other women that were connected to Robert Durst that have gone missing. Now, there's no evidence, again, to connect him to their disappearances. But like we said when we started off, people around him seem to disappear or be killed. And that's why the documentary is called The Jinx. Is it just that he's the jinx and everybody around him finds misfortune? I don't know. Does this even seem like a real story? That's my next question to you. If I just brought this to you and we didn't do a podcast and we never talked about true crime, you just think this was like a silly movie plot or something, right?
It seems like a movie where they were trying to talk about an evil genius who got away with some stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe all this stuff happened. I think it's even harder to believe that this guy's not sitting in jail for the murder of Morris Black right now.
Yeah, there's so many unbelievable pieces here, from him writing that letter, the cadaver letter, continuing to spell Beverly Hills wrong, and not to think that the handwriting could get tracked back to him, to admitting to killing Morris Black and cutting his body up and being found not guilty, and to blatantly telling police and the people making the documentary that he lied about calling his wife in New York and talking to her there. And it's not like he's great at getting away with these things. He's leaving evidence everywhere, and it seems that now it's finally getting around to biting him. I don't know that he's going to be charged in his wife's disappearance. She has been deemed legally dead after being missing for so long. What does justice in this case look like? Is it even possible for him?
I think it is possible. I think it's great that they're going to talk about what happened in Morris Black's case, but I think justice is going to be found if he is found guilty of murder of Susan Berman. But I mean, when we talk about justice, we need to talk about it for all his victims, right? It sounds like he's never going to really have justice for Morris Black's case. I don't know that he's ever going to face justice for the disappearance of his wife, Kathy, and these other potential victims that have disappeared. So it seems like justice has the potential to be served on behalf of Berman, but for the others, I don't think that it's there. What do you think?
He's going to be 76 years old by the time this trial begins in September of 2019. By the time it ends, he could be 78 years old. And, I mean, he has spent a couple of years in prison for some of the minor charges, but, I mean, we're looking at him. His wife disappeared in 1982. Susan Berman was killed around 2000. Morris Black in 2001. And he has spent his entire 76 years as a free man. And I really don't think he can get justice. Like, if you find a killer on their deathbed and sentence them to jail, like, no justice is served there, right? He's not going to spend any time in prison or paying for these crimes.
That's true. And yeah, I definitely agree with what you're saying. Not enough time spent being punished, but I guess at least if he is found guilty for Berman's death, at least on paper, and formally being convicted of that would, you know, that's at least a good start.
Sure.
I guess.
And that's a step to the family for sure. And Morris Black's family knows that Robert Durst was responsible for his death as well. So justice, no. Some truth, hopefully, maybe at some point, if he is found guilty for this and put in prison for the rest of his life, that he will come clean about some other things he has done. Maybe he'll talk more about what happened to his wife, Kathy, because he knows there's nothing he can do to get out of jail. I don't know. I guess that's the silver lining to all this, is that we find out what really happened to his wife, if he's willing to confess after convicted for this.
We spoke a few weeks ago about truth serum being used, and I thought that was kind of a made-up thing, but apparently it's been used in some cases. I mean, this guy's 76 years old. Why don't we hook him up to an IV for about a year with this stuff running through his body, and let's hear what all he has to say at that point. I mean, that sounds a little harsh and a little weird for me to say, but I think his whole life has been one major deception after the other. So I would just like what you said is the truth to come out.
I agree. And I hope we get it. Like I said, I think that may be the only positive to come out of a potential conviction here. As always, we'll keep you guys updated as there are updates on that case. Again, the trial doesn't start till September of this coming year. So we'll let you know when we get updates from that. And as always, we'll have some other updates on our next Patreon episode, which is going to drop on March 1st.
Yeah, guys, you're not going to want to miss that. We're going to be talking about some crimes that have happened over the years in some game show history. So it's going to be pretty interesting. Check us out on Patreon. If you're not able to do that, one of the best ways you can help the show is to leave a rating and review. Those are free, just takes a few minutes of your time, but greatly help the show. So guys, thank you all for listening all the way through. Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media.